AIDS continues to be a crisis around the globe, especially for women.
For every one guy that's infected in South Africa, there are about 3.5 women infected. Everyone knows someone who's either passed away from an AIDS-related disease or who is ill.
I'm Julia Taylor. You're listening to the Women's Issues Show 51%. My co-host is Jean Neff, president of the Sage Colleges in Troy and Albany, New York.
As AIDS continues to spread, we'll zero in on a few parts of the world where folks are striving to make a difference. We'll also talk about this disease's unique impact on women.
It's coming up on 51%. The statistics are never easy to hear. As of 2004, the Centers for Disease Control reported that about one quarter of people suffering from HIV and AIDS were women. According to a UN survey conducted last year, women's share of the disease was about half.
That disparity may show a vast increase in women who've contracted HIV/AIDS. It may show the nebulous data that different organizations put out about the disease, or it may show a little bit of both.
While the overall picture of AIDS seems fuzzy, the focus is all too sharp for people who have the disease or who are working to combat its spread. Gail Johnson runs a South African non-governmental organization, or NGO, called Nkosi's Haven. Named after Johnson's adoptive son, who died of AIDS, she provides a place where mothers with the disease and their children can live, work, and go to school.
Johnson's is a difficult job, especially because she's constantly out raising money for her cause.
I sat down with Johnson when she was on a fundraising trip in the U.S. to talk about how she started Nkosi's Haven and how she hopes to continue battling AIDS.
For every one guy that's infected in South Africa, there are about 3.5 women infected. And they're vulnerable to it because our average black woman is maybe semi-literate. She's unemployed. We have a very high rate of unemployment. And she's vulnerable to abuse in as much as she will get in a relationship for a roof over her head and food in her stomach. Mm-hmm. And if he wants to have unprotected sex, he'll have it. She'll fall pregnant, and when she announces her pregnancy, he'll either abandon her or kick her out. So they are totally unempowered when it comes to their own sexuality. Mm-hmm. And a lot of moms are moms through circumstance, not through maternal want. It's scary.
How does it show itself day to day in the country, would you say?
There are still so many people in denial. We have confusing messages coming in from all sorts of angles. Everyone knows someone who's either passed away from an AIDS-related disease or who is ill.
Let's talk a little bit about your son, Nkosi, starting with how you found him.
I think he found me. Mm. I was one of the founder members of another care center called the Guest House, and that was in 1990. At that stage of the pandemic, it was white gay men, as in the Western world. But of course he was admitted. One of our board members was a virologist, professor, doctor, and of course he ended up with him, and that's when of course he was diagnosed. And then, of course, his mother was absolutely petrified of taking him back into the township. So he was admitted to the guest house. Mm-hmm. So we had a whole lot of gay guys who fell in love with this little black boy who was half the size of nothing.
Uh-huh.
And it was just a stunning vibe. But then the guest house closed due to lack of funds. So I took Nkosi home.
Over the course of your relationship with him and towards the end of his life, he was sort of described in a news report as a soap opera drama. You know, everyone around South Africa was very interested in him and his progress. Why do you think people were able to connect with him when, as you say, now people seem to be bored with this message?
Of course, he spoke out about HIV/AIDS. But it was easier because I was obviously not his biological mother. So we brought him up never to be ashamed or embarrassed mm-hmm. about his HIV status. With him coming into my home, to make him, and this is going to sound terrible, but sociably acceptable with my circle of friends, we started talking about the baddies in his blood right in the beginning when we got him. And he had just turned 3. I met him when he was 2.
Mm-hmm.
We then also tried to get him into school. And because he'd been reasonably visible in our suburb, I thought I'd be pretty open about his status when I filled in the application form, which created havoc. We were lead story nationally and internationally for quite a few days while the school was deciding whether they would take him or not. That experience was the first time he'd ever experienced being discriminated against as an infected child. He wanted to speak out more and more about it. So he became a little spokesman. And the sicker he got, the more he wanted to do. And then, of course, he spoke at the World AIDS Conference. So, of course, he basically broke the silence. He gave AIDS a face.
And so since then, you have gone on, and while he was still alive, you founded the first Necosis Haven. Tell me a little bit about that and what mothers and children and orphans find there.
Chaos.
Organized chaos, I'm sure.
Corsi and I often used to speak about starting something for other kids. Uh-huh. He was terribly, terribly worried about other children. What's happening to them, mommy, and things like that. So we used to go looking around for properties because I thought, let's start a facility for other infected kids. And then his mom died, and I took him to the funeral. And then driving back, he said to me, you know, mommy never said goodbye. And I thought, this is just so wrong. A child should be with its mother when either one of them are dying. But they weren't together. And I thought, wrong. I've got to do something about it. Mm. So I said to him, should we look at starting something for mums and kids? And he said, yes, please. I was offered a house rent free for 5 years. And I thought, well, bite the bullet. Go for it. No bank balance, no check account, no nothing. But at the moment, we've got 17 mums and 64 kids in the two houses next door to each other. And it's just growing and growing because we target the destitute mum, as I say, HIV-infected mum. But we draw up a last will and testament with her. And if she wants us to keep her kids, we do. So we're mums and kids and AIDS orphans. Mm-hmm.
I would imagine you have more women than you have space at Necosis Haven. How do you handle that?
I hate that.
Yeah.
I hate it, and I hate being confronted with it. But if a mom is in a family environment, but she's in the out room, but a roof over her head, and another mother is under a bridge, I will look at that mom first. Mm-hmm. We're a long-term facility, so I've got to build more facilities rather than have a high turnover. Because now with ARV rollout, my moms are lasting a lot longer.
And ARV is a drug.
Antiretroviral mm-hmm. Therapy. So yeah, we're developing the village, and that'll accommodate 100 moms and 183 kids. That's about 60% completed. Mm-hmm. And then we've bought a farm that I want to set up in the sort of kibbutz style of living. And then, yeah, take the project nationwide.
As you sort of alluded to, in the first place, it's a big undertaking to run a facility for kids, for orphans, and for women who don't have a home. But then add in the element of these women suffering from a terminal illness. How do you care for them in that way and keep watch over all of these people?
Well, you sort of do it with cigarettes in the hand and coffee, you know, but we have a resident therapist, so as my moms come in, they get put into the schedule. So they're counseled around acceptance of their HIV status. Mm-hmm. Then she's counseled around disclosing to her kids, because a lot of women do not disclose to their children. And suddenly they're living in an environment where they hear nothing but HIV AIDS. We normalize it totally, but everyone's talking it. Mm-hmm. So we've got to prepare the kids. Then, dependent on the age of the kids, mom is also counseled around having her kids tested if they haven't been. Then, if the child is infected, counseling mom on how to disclose to child. We try and build the capacity of the moms and those that show initiative we employ internally. Like a mom is now our chef, and we have a couple of moms who are childcare workers. So at the village, we'll empower them even more and build their capacities even more, because I'll have about 20 divisions that I need run by my moms.
How have you found is the best vehicle for raising funds to keep Necosis Haven growing?
Our biggest supporter is the Soweto Gospel Choir. When they tour internationally, they've just won a Grammy. They have a silver collection after each performance. Necosis Haven gets 50% of that. But it's difficult because in South Africa you've got 96,000 registered AIDS non-profit organizations, and we're all going for the same rand. And AIDS orphans is the last new category, for want of a better word. We're exhausted in South Africa. There are so many needs and so many people who are deprived of just a loaf of bread a day. And we need to address that. So it's heavy going.
I want to ask you a little bit about you, because you seem extremely tireless in this, between running the facility and also coming to the U.S. and raising money. What was it like to take the journey from having this foster child, enrolling him in school, dealing with media attention and, frankly, criticism for exposing him to the limelight, and some criticism saying, you know, this kid is sick, he shouldn't be traveling as much as he is, to now running this NGO in his memory? What is that like personally?
If something needs to be done, I do it. So, of course, he didn't have anywhere to go, and at a board meeting, I said, I'll take him home. So he moved in. I didn't ask the family. I told the family. Mm-hmm. I don't like people saying no. So if you ask people, they have the time to think about things. The loss of him was horrendous. Him being in a coma blew my mind, because AIDS silenced him. He was outspoken against AIDS. It silenced him. And I hated to see my boy in a coma. And he was my partner. And he wanted to do it. And I committed to him to carrying on. So from an emotional point of view, I've learned so much, and I still learn daily the many facets of people's emotions, the traumas, the unbelievable hurt that people go through, my moms go through, my kids go through, and I want to soften that hurt. So I've learned a lot. But I know I don't look like anyone who runs a non-profit organization. And I think people have a problem with that, because they have a preconceived idea of what someone should look like. You know, sort of meek and mild. I'm not. And if I want my nails long, I've got huge hands, I'll have long nails. If I want my hair red, I'm going to have red hair. That doesn't mean I am not sincere about my project. That doesn't mean that I care a lot. I care the world for my kids. I care the world for my moms. Not as important as my kids, but, you know, do I have to look like a Mother Teresa to be sincere? No, I don't think so.
Thank you for stopping by. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great. Thank you.
Gail Johnson heads up Nkosi's Haven in South Africa. For more information, you can visit www.nkosi.iafrica.com.
Coming up on the program, we'll look at AIDS in other parts of the world.
If you missed part of the show, you can listen to 51% anytime. Just download our podcast at wamc.org.
Or call 1-800-323-9262 to order a CD. Be sure to have the program number ready. This week, it's number 976. These days, many news stories focus on AIDS in Africa or elsewhere in the world, but there are still many women living with HIV/AIDS right here in the United States.
Independent producer Julia Applegate spoke to several women in Ohio who are HIV positive about their experiences.
My name is China. I found out that I was HIV positive 7.5 years ago.
My name is Pam Jones. I was diagnosed in 2000. I have had it for about 10 years or longer.
I'm Susie. I'm 52. I'm from Dayton, and I've been HIV positive for 14 years.
My name is Pamela Westbrook, and I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio. I have HIV for 4 years.
My name is Mary, and I've been affected for 19 years now.
I'm Vicky, and I'm from Columbus, Ohio, and I've been positive for 5.5 years.
My name is Pam. I am 45 years old. I have been HIV positive for 2 years.
When I got the diagnosis, you know, I just sat there crying in the doctor's office, and I drove home and just, I had my head on my hand, just leaning against the window, driving home in a daze.
I said, I'm in shock. I just cannot believe that it's positive. It's just not what I expected at all. I mean, I'd even sort of gone inside myself before that I got the results of the test and you know, heard this sort of, you know, it'll be okay, it'll be fine. Yeah. So I was just floored.
An hour after I told him, he went to a health food store, which was right by my house. And he came back with all these herbal remedies and this book on a cure. And, you know, the red flag didn't go up. But now, today, looking back on it, I'm like, he knew he was positive. Mm-hmm. But when he came back with all that stuff, I'm thinking, wow, he's smart. He's going to try to save my life. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Huh. I honestly don't know to this day that he still didn't know, that he really didn't know.
I was affected by somebody that I really trusted was my husband. And I didn't find out that until 91, that he had it. And he had it when I met him, and he didn't tell me about it.
I have two kids from my first marriage. And I've told my kids, of course, when I first got it, one of the hardest things I've ever done. But my kids are... right now they're 18 and 20, so they were 16 and 18 when they found out. And the first thing they thought is I was going to die, because, you know, I thought I was going to die.
Only one knows that I'm HIV positive is my sister and my son. I'm just not ready to let anyone else know that I'm HIV positive.
My biggest thing is the effect that it had on me. I've always been a confident person and just out there, very talkative, very open. And I went from that really outgoing person to being an extreme introvert, mm-hmm. feeling that, you know, I have absolutely no self-worth, no self-confidence, no self-esteem. I mean, you're talking being cut in half to what I used to be.
I would like to come out and tell people that I have it, so they could see that it doesn't have a special face on it. It has, you can be anybody, and that's how it gets spread, because you don't know, because it doesn't have, you know, on your forehead, I have AIDS or I have HIV.
I just wish that everything would change, and there would be a change where everybody would accept the disease as other diseases, because the disease is just what it is. It's a disease like cancer or anything else. It has made me having HIV made me stronger.
It's transformed my life in actually some good ways, I would say. It's helped me be closer to other people, to be more honest, I think, with my friends. And it's taken a long time for me to get to the point where I can say, yes, it's transformed my life in some positive ways.
I have made friends that I would never have met with HIV, so in a way it has helped me out a lot.
I believe that, you know, you have to believe in yourself, and you have to believe in your power of your mind, and that's the only way you're going to get through it, is to go on and believe that, you know, things will continue. You know, or they won't. One or the other, life will go on. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to live mine till it's done.
I'm just ready to live. You know, it's a hard thing, but we have a good support group if we're strong women, and we are strong women, regardless, whatever cultural background, we're strong women. I feel we're strong women, first of all, to be able to give birth, to put up with the things that we have put up with coming up as women. We are strong, but if you get a good support group, we can all survive it. You know, we just need to come together and try to support each other, because it's hard. It's extremely hard.
Independent producer Julia Applegate spoke to HIV-positive women living in Ohio.
The spread of AIDS often comes from a lack of education about safe sex. In India, healthcare workers worry about the virus among the country's 3 million prostitutes and 6 million long-distance truck drivers.
The Gates Foundation is funding a trucker education program designed to protect Indian truck drivers from getting HIV/AIDS when they spend time with prostitutes at truck stops. Miranda Kennedy reports.
Take your average truck driver in India. He spends 15 or 20 days of a month on the road. He's pretty likely to visit inexpensive commercial sex workers at highway truck stops, like this one outside New Delhi, during the long stretches away from his family. These truck stops offer chai, cheap food, spare parts, and sex. If the trucker catches HIV here, he'll take it back to his wife in his village. Trucker Gulmir Singh has seen it firsthand. Recently, he lost a friend to AIDS.
He always had a fever. He was weak and emaciated. And even though he took medicine, he never got better. Most of the day, he couldn't move from his bed. And then, after 3 years, he died. We're all afraid of this dangerous disease, and we have talked amongst ourselves about how to be careful not to get it.
Gulmir admits his friend's death hasn't stopped him from cheating on his wife with prostitutes. Gulmir, like many truck drivers in India, believes that if he doesn't have sex for a long time, it will result in death or blindness. So they're unfaithful when they're on the road. What has changed is that Gulmir now uses a condom. He learned that condoms help protect against HIV from a peer education project promoted by the Gates Foundation. The project trains truckers to tell other truckers about AIDS, how it's spread, and how to reduce the risk of getting it through condom use. Akash, a truck mechanic, is coded in Greece, and he talks in the dialect used by many truckers in these parts. He explains how condoms protect against AIDS and is quick to put to rest the common trucker myths about needing to have sex when they're away from home. The Gates Foundation refuses to take a moral stand on the issue of men being unfaithful to their wives and paying for prostitutes. So to keep the AIDS epidemic from skyrocketing across the country, the Gates Foundation's goal is simply to promote condom use. Cedric Finch is Regional Health Program Director for the humanitarian aid group CARE in India. He says that when CARE talks to truck drivers, they emphasize abstinence and faithfulness first, before talking about condoms.
Abstinence, definitely we suggest to them because we feel that that's the best way. They need to be faithful to their spouses.
They sometimes even help truckers decide not to visit commercial sex workers.
If I'm able to just talk to him during that period about himself, about his kids, about his family, just remind him of them. Just trying to take him away from thinking about going to a commercial sex worker.
Asha Rao is project director of the AIDS Prevention Program at India's largest trucking company, the Transport Corporation of India.
It's not that they're not concerned about the family at home. It's not that they don't save money for their children. But the lifestyle is so different. So it's like in a total switch from one lifestyle to another when they are at home, which is also for a very short duration. So when you go home, you buy this gift, you buy that gift, you're with your wife for a short while, and then again you're back on the roads.
Rao says it wasn't hard for the Gates Foundation to convince the trucking company to work with them to help cut down AIDS infections among truckers. Some estimates have found that 10% of India's trucker population is already HIV positive. That figure is high enough to make any trucking executive care about what his workers do at night.
Independent producer Miranda Kennedy filed that report from India.
That's it for our show on HIV/AIDS. We'll leave you with this quote from celebrated author and informed cynic, Barbara Ehrenreich.
From the point of view of the pharmaceutical industry, the AIDS problem has already been solved. After all, we have a drug which can be sold at the incredible price of $8,000 an annual dose, and which has the added virtue of not diminishing the market by actually curing anyone.
I'm Julia Taylor.
And I'm Jean Neff. If you have any comments about today's show or ideas for future shows, please email Julia at jtaylor@wamc.org.
Thanks to Allison Clark and Sarah LeDuc for production help on this episode. And as always, thanks for listening to 51%.
Support for 51% comes from Russell Sage College, New York, educating women of influence for the 21st century.